accession number 18774, Reel 3.
Tony Sellhurst, Reel 3. I was just going to ask you what living conditions were like in the different ships that you served in.
Well, I've already described the conditions in the armed merchant cruiser. You slept in hammocks, and you had mess table for lunch, and about 14 in the mess, and wooden tables, and you sometimes in the evening, well, not sometimes, but always in the evenings, people used to sling the hammocks, and they were slung above the tables that you used to eat on. So it was a bit of a nuisance if you were eating, and someone had gone to sleep in his hammock. Most of them were told to put their hammocks away, but some left them up there. In the frigate, the conditions were exceptionally good. I had a very comfortable cabin. She was a new ship. She has a very big wardroom of about 24 feet by 14. She had 8 officers, and we had the flotilla doctor, who unfortunately was hurt when or injured when we were blown up. And we also had the flotilla engineer officer, who was a warrant engineer officer, RN. And she was a very fine ship, and a very comfortable ship, 24 knots, and turbines, which were very quiet and smooth when you're underway. The corvette, the conditions were very different. There were two of us in the cabin, about 8 foot square. I was in that for about a year and a half with a cabin mate called Mark Hammond, who became a close friend. And we got on fine and no trouble. But we had very heavy weather, and one of the what's known as the tank tops, where the diesel, where the fuel tanks are, there's a round area, a round circular plate, which is about 2 foot round, secured with about 30 nuts. Well, in very heavy weather, the fuel used to slap up and underneath it, and it leaked. And I remember one of the occasions, I came down off watch after the middle watch at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I found we had a steward between four officers. There were only four officers and one midshipman for training, including the captain. And I came down off watch, and the chief steward was down there, a fellow called Mitchell. He was as white as a sheet, and he was mopping up oil fuel, and my shirts had come out of my drawer, and they were all covered in oil fuel. And I didn't care. All I wanted to do was lie on my bunk and go to sleep. But I thought I'd cheer Mitchell up, and I said, "Mitchell, how is it that you got into the Navy like this? Are you enjoying being a chief steward?" He said, "No, I don't like being a chief steward." And he said, "I wasn't in the Navy pre-war. So I said, "Well, what did you used to do?" And he said, looked at me with very steady eyes and said, "I used to keep pigs." And I took the message and I said, "Well, just leave the oil where it is in the morning. We'll mop it all up." And that's that. So off he went, and he turned in as well. But it was, the conditions there were very different. The Flower Class corvettes were marvelous ships at sea, far better than destroyers, in my opinion, far better than the frigate. In a seaway, you very seldom took a heavy sea in. They were designed after seagoing trawlers. And so at sea, in a very heavy sea, and there were plenty of very heavy seas, the corvette used to behave like a duck and bounce over them all. The frigates and destroyers used to stick their noses into the big seas, and you got soaked on the bridges, sea poured over you. But accommodation-wise, obviously because it was a much smaller ship, the accommodation was not nearly as good. And, of course, the ships could only do 16 knots flat out. But they were a very good little convoy escort vessel, and that's what they were built for.
And what about the New Zealand ship?
The New Zealand ship, the Manawa, was an armed merchant cruiser. She was comfortable in terms of the fact that there was a lot of accommodation, and the officers all had their own cabins and all that sort of thing, but the ratings were jam-packed tight, and as I said originally, I think there were 20 of us in this cabin called the Jungle. But we had bunks. We weren't in hammocks. And that was a great boon, to be able to go to sleep in a bunk without having to get a hammock out and rig it and put the battens in and all the rest of it.
The battens?
The battens were two pieces of wood you spread across the top and the bottom of your hammock to hold it apart, so that when you jumped in, the whole thing didn't close around you like a cocoon. But they were very comfortable, and there's no doubt about it. They're very handy, and they were used, of course, when if a ship was hit with torpedoes or whatever and holed in one side, you used to stuff hammocks into the hole to keep the water out. That was one of the damage control exercises.
So bunks had a lot of advantages.
Well, I liked bunks better than hammocks because it wasn't that they were so much more comfortable, but there wasn't so much trouble. Every time you had a hammock, you had to, what was known as sling it, and you, there was a rope at one end of it, and you tied that round an iron bar on the deckhead, and at the other end there was another rope, and you hung, that had to be tied up, and then you had to make the bed with a palliasse of straw, and that was put along the canvas of the hammock itself. And then you had to get into the darn thing, and quite frequently you could jump up in it, and if the ship was rolling, the hammock would swing one way, and you'd be jumping the other way, and you'd miss it. And so you were left hanging in mid-air trying to get into it. So it was a bit of a bother, but once in it, the ship used to roll, and of course the hammock stayed still. Whereas in a bunk, when the ship was rolling or pitching or whatever, the bunk would roll and pitch with it. And you used to jam yourself into the bunk by bringing your knees up to your chin sort of thing and jamming yourself against what were known as bunk boards, which were there to stop you falling out. So that they both had their advantages, but I preferred the bunk in the end.
Did it mean that you wouldn't be seasick in a hammock?
I was, once you got to sea, as far as seasickness was concerned, I was only sick when I first went to sea. And I think that possibly was fear and trepidation, and I wasn't used to climbing ratlins and things, and I wasn't used to snowstorms in the North Atlantic. But I soon got used to that. And so the funny thing was that I was sick on the California going across on my first voyage. I think I was sick once on Ascania in another North Atlantic voyage with convoys. But when I joined the small ships, the frigate and the corvette, for some reason I was seldom ill. Now, whether that was because you have additional responsibilities and you're the officer of the watch and you're thinking of a lot of things, I think it's once you've got nothing to think about and you're just sitting there thinking, oh Lord, I'm going to be ill, that you are ill. If you haven't got time to sit and think, oh, I'm going to be ill, then you're not ill. There are, of course, exceptions. There are certain chaps. I mean, in the corvette, I suppose we lost a fellow every voyage through sickness who was totally incurable. It didn't matter how much dry biscuits or dry bread you forced down his throat, he was still ill. So that these chaps were sent ashore, and they either went to a shore base or they went to big ships. But I personally was very happy in small ships.
Did the New Zealanders have a different attitude and outlook from Englishmen?
That's a very leading question. My opinion, and I stand to be corrected, was that generally speaking, the New Zealanders, man for man, were of a higher educational standard than the British sailors. I'm not saying that they were better sailors, but I am saying that educationally, they seemed to be of a higher standard, and nearly all of them wanted to progress, nearly all of them. And that included, and I got lots of names and cards from them, farmers and so on and so forth, but they seemed to be of a higher educational standard. And it could be that with a little country with only 3 million people in it, that it's easier to get on and to make your way in educationally.
Did you like them?
I liked the New Zealanders very much, yes. Yes, I did. I was very happy, and I was very happy to... I thought when I got my commission, I would be a sub-lieutenant RNZN, but no, because it was a very much better paid job. Very much better pay, I should say. But no sooner had I got a commission than I was back to the British Navy, and that standard of pay, which was very much less, about half than the RNZN and the Australian Navy, for that matter.
I didn't quite follow what you meant by netted.
Natted is the Germans had a torpedo which was developed and called a NAT, G-N-A-T. And a NAT was fired from the U-boat at the ship, and as it approached the ship, it picked up the vibrations from the propellers, and it homed on the vibrations. And a lot of ships were natted before they found the answer. And the answer that we had in HMS Cam, we were given, and we used to steam and trail, was nothing more nor less than four iron bars about 3 feet across, very close together, and you streamed them over the stern at a distance of up to 500 yards. Anything from 200 to 500 yards. And these streamed astern of you, and they made a loud chattering noise, so that when you were steaming along, if a U-boat fired a NAT at you, it picked up the noise of the what it was called, Foxer. And it would pick up a Foxer, and I have actually seen the Foxers blow up. So it was a very clever method of trying to de-NAT NATs.
So it was a decoy, really?
It was a very good decoy, yes. Very good, it worked. And it was very simple, and it was cheap. And we were all issued, all ships were given several sets of Foxes. Because it was a damn nuisance getting them out and getting them in again, but it was worth it.
What is a Robinson stretcher?
A Robinson stretcher is a type of stretcher where it's very difficult to describe it. There are four pieces of wood about 6 feet long and about 2 inches diameter, and they're strapped together, they're lashed together with canvas, pieces of canvas about a foot long, right round the stretcher. And you put the fellow on this stretcher, and then you wrap it round him with his arms tight alongside him, and you lash the whole stretcher together, and at one end of it there's a ring, and you can put a rope through that ring, and then you can lift the whole thing. And so from a height of, in Nick Cam's case, about 30 feet up these ladders from the boiler room floor, you can put this Robinson with a man in it vertically, and the chaps up top can pull him up and up through a little hole at the top, which was only about 3 feet diameter. And that's the Robinson, as opposed to a normal stretcher, which you just put down and lift a fellow up. And they're very useful for, I mean, I think firemen and people like that still have Robinson's type of stretchers.
How do you feel now in 1999 about having served in the Second World War in the Royal Navy?
How do I feel now? I feel that looking back on it, I wouldn't have missed it for all the tea in China. I joined it not knowing what it was all about, but I joined it because basically I wanted to go to sea. I also joined it because I wanted to go join the Navy. And I look back on my time with the Navy and everything I learned in that five and a half years at sea, I look back on that as being basically the very foundation of everything I've done and everything I've learned since. I've also learned that people may grumble and moan in this present day and age, if people seem to be spending their lives grumbling about something, they don't really know what they're grumbling about. And when I laugh, when I sit down and laugh sometimes at when I read about, and I probably shouldn't say it, soccer players and all these managers and all these people who are under pressure, they don't know what pressure is, in my opinion, and that might be just an old man talking, and no doubt my father said the same thing about us. Maybe we moaned, but I'd love to have been given the opportunity of having pressure put on me for about £30,000 a week, and that's the way I see it now. I think that the war did me nothing but good. I think it's a dreadful thing to have happened. I was lucky, I survived it. I still suffer from it, I still have nightmares over it, but overall it did me nothing but good. And when I joined the RNR after the war and continued on until I became a commander, it was wonderful. It did me nothing but good. It did me nothing but good, not only as a person, but I'm sure it did me nothing but good in my career, in my work, and my attitude to life.
What is the content of these nightmares to which you refer?
Oh, I frequently throw myself out of bed and I'm abandoning ship and I'm doing stupid things. My wife gets fed up with it and so do I, but there's nothing you can do about it. I can't exactly go to the doctor and say, excuse me, but I keep throwing myself out of bed because of something that happened 60 years ago. And there's lots of chaps like me.
This is the CAM, is it?
This is the CAM, yes. I still have nightmares, at least once a month. And in fact, it gets embarrassing sometimes when you go away and stay with friends and you're suddenly shouting out in the middle of the night that you're going to hit the bastard. It's not a very good thing to do. But I do it.